I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Millennial Woes. Woes, welcome back.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me. I think we're going to have a good time talking about the two topics we've got lined up.
Yeah, the first of these topics, and the biggest of these topics, is Rupert Lowe and Restore Britain. I know very little about this guy. I realized, and this is sort of a story that's emblematic of this social media age, right? Rupert Lowe was just somebody that I noticed on X when I was still on X. I was recently banned yet again in an alt account. And I noticed him because he was being retweeted or quote tweeted by friends of mine in the UK. And I thought, wow, this guy's based. And then it came out that he's actually an MP, which surprised me. And so I followed him, and he was just a social media person with very good takes, send them all back kinds of takes, let's look into the grooming gang type takes. Very, very well stated, radical points. And I was very impressed. And then sometime after I was finally canned, I heard that he's created a new party. And the day that the announcement came out, immediately I said, great, this is the guy. I started looking at my friends on Telegram. This is the guy. This is the guy. Everybody who looked at him from our camp, from our point of view, knew a good thing when they saw it. And it was immediate. It was totally organic. Everyone just said, Lowe is the guy. And then I realized, wait a second here. I have just endorsed for the future of my ancestral homeland, not my own country, but a country that's dear to my heart, a guy that I just knew from social media. He's just a name on social media. And I was immediately thinking, yes, prime minister, Lord Protector, whatever it takes, give him all powers. And I thought, wait a sec, maybe I should just step back a bit and inform myself. And so I thought of you, because you've been watching this a lot longer than I have, and you know a bit more about him. And so I thought, let's bring Woes on. Surely there are other Americans as naive as me. And so I just want to ask super naive questions about Rupert Lowe and Restore Britain. And then we'll get into some of the deeper waters. And at the end of this, I'm quite certain that I will not have changed my mind a bit and think, yes, this guy is the right guy for Great Britain. All power to Rupert Lowe. So Woes, can you tell me a little bit about the guy, the background, and when he first came on the radar for you?
Well, for me, it was a couple of years ago when he was involved with Reform UK, and he was one of the leading lights there. He was one of the most prominent people. But other people knew him a long time ago. People who are into football, because he was involved with, I think it's Southampton Football Club. And more recently, he's been involved with other in general. And I don't want to be precise because I'll get it wrong. But he was, in the first place, a successful businessman. He had a long career in business, including in the city. I think he was a stockbroker, like Nigel Farage. He was definitely involved in high finance. And so he had a long career in that. And then more recently, I don't know exactly when, I think it was about 10 years ago, he bought a farm in up north somewhere, and he's been running that as well. He's also involved with many different charities. And 10 years ago, he got involved with the Brexit push. And I think some people would have first encountered him then. I didn't, but I think a lot of people did. And so he was involved with that. And then, I think on the back of that, that was the Brexit Party, which became Reform UK, and he was then involved with Reform UK. And in that capacity, he got voted in as an MP, a Member of Parliament, in the House of Commons. And that is when a lot of people will have encountered him for the first time, because using the resources that are uniquely available to MPs, he has done a lot of good work. Oh, it's one other thing that's worth saying is that he donates his MP's salary to charity because he's rich, so he doesn't need that money. So it goes to charity, which is nice. But then he's done all these good works while in Parliament. He's putting all these questions to the House. He's using the apparatus of government to get things done that no other politician has done. Given the parlous state of our country, it's astonishing that no other politician has done what Rupert Lowe has done in the last 2 years. And all of this culminates with the independent rape gang inquiry, which he organized himself. He organized the funding of it. He didn't fund it himself, but he organized the funding of it back from the public. And he chaired it. It recently happened, and he was the chair. And this was all done because he didn't trust, and rightly, I think, he didn't trust the government to do a proper rape inquiry into this matter. And bear in mind, this is an absolutely crucial matter. This is the most important thing that is going on in Britain just now. And it's the biggest scandal in Britain, I don't know, in my lifetime, I would say. I don't know what could rise, maybe even longer than that. I remember when I first heard about it in 2014, I thought this is the biggest thing to happen, the most important thing to happen in Britain in 100 years. And I think that's probably true. I still think that now. And yet it's just been buried time and time and time again. And with the Labour government, I think, I can't remember the tangled history of this with Starmer, but I think they first were refusing to do an inquiry, and then eventually they agreed, but then there were signs that it was going to be compromised, and that, I think, is when Rupert Lowe decided to do his own one, the independent inquiry. And this, I haven't looked at the testimonies that have come in from that, because I just can't stand it. I've been talking about this matter for 12 years now, so I feel like I've done my bit. I feel like I don't need to know the details, because it's just so awful. I know that it's really bad, and that's enough. That's all I need to know. The general thing is just horrifying. The details, I think, would just be very disturbing. So, but it is important that someone collects and catalogues these details, because this should be known. It's outrageous that it isn't known. It's outrageous that the government hasn't done this already. Yeah. It's outrageous that the government allowed this scandal to happen in the first place. It's outrageous that the government allowed the men who did it into the country in the first place.
Right.
So, yeah. Sorry, go on.
There need to be Nuremberg tribunals eventually.
Oh, yeah.
For the people who perpetrated this, the people in the government who covered it up, and therefore it's important
level,
to get
not
all
just the government. I mean, the police, yeah. The schools, the social services,
the everything. Press.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So, interestingly enough, even though this is a great service for the people of Great Britain, it was the rape gang inquiry that got Rupert Lowe thrown out of Nigel Farage's party. Isn't that the case?
That's not true. What got him thrown out, really, is that he was overshadowing Nigel Farage by asking so many questions in Parliament, by performing so well on social media, by saying the things that people wanted to hear, and so forth. The rape gang inquiry actually happened after he was, after he left Reform. I think, I don't know if it was in the offing when he was still in Reform. I don't know. But either way, it's not what got him thrown out. What got him thrown out was that he was a threat to Nigel Farage. And one thing I'll say just before we get into that is that the rape gang inquiry has been happening for the last month or so. It has been entirely ignored by the media. I think there was one mention in the Daily Mail. And it has been entirely ignored also by Nigel Farage. No one, and the BBC, as far as I know, they've not even mentioned it once. It's absolutely astonishing that, and it's right out in the open. This is why the crime was able to happen in the first place, because of this attitude that the media and the government are now showing to an inquiry about the crime, which is that they want to ignore it. They want to sweep it under the rug. It's so out in the open. It's so in your face. This is why it happened in the first place. So anyway, I shouldn't get carried away. but it's just disgusting. And then Nigel Farage ignoring it as well, when he himself has paid lip service to people's concerns about this matter, but then he doesn't mention the inquiry that's going on about it. The whole thing is despicable. There's no other word.
Let's then go into Lowe's expulsion, basically, from the Reform Party. The skullduggery that accompanied that, including basically reporting him to the police for fake crimes. Farage recently just got up and basically admitted that they had to tell these lies and play hardball because he was such a dangerous person in their party.
Yes, yes.
It's extraordinary. We really need to spend a bit of time talking about Farage, because ultimately, in the minds of a lot of people, it's going to be a question of Lowe or Farage. The only question that a lot of people have on their minds right now is, can Lowe beat Farage? Can Lowe win? And that I think is extremely important too. But to answer that question, it really becomes a question of character, and especially the character of Nigel Farage. Because even if Nigel Farage won, Great Britain would not win anything, given the character of the man that has been demonstrated now for decades and has especially become clear recently in his treatment of Rupert Lowe. So we need to go into this, because that really is, for me, the thing that is the deciding factor. Ultimately, even if people came forward with charts and graphs and said, Wonks came forward and said, Lowe can only do ill for the cause of remigration. Only Farage can get elected. Lowe's a spoiler. My answer is, look at the man that you want as PM. He doesn't have the character to get it done. And that's Nigel Farage.
Yeah, and Elon Musk actually said that as well. He said, I can't remember his exact wording, but I think it was, Nigel Farage doesn't have what it takes. Reform need to get a better leader. And that was a year ago. That was last January, because I looked it up recently. I agree with you. Sometimes you can go on your gut instinct about the person rather than all of the circumstances surrounding it and all of the information. You have to, sometimes it's just so glaring. It's just so obvious. And to me, this is one of those instances where Nigel Farage is just clearly a cheap snake oil salesman, a trickster, a showman, shallow, insincere, all the rest of it. Whereas Rupert Lowe is not. He's a serious man and a good man. And I'm not saying that he's perfect or anything like that. I'm just saying what I've just said. I think he is a good man. And that alone is enough in this day and age, because how many politicians can you say that about? I mean, it's infested. Governmental systems in every Western country are infested with just low life. And it's almost like it's an accident that Rupert Lowe got into the House of Parliament at all, into the House of Commons. I think Nigel Farage probably regrets that now. Because not only has it caused trouble for him, but it's caused trouble for the people who he sucks up to, the establishment, basically. So, yeah, to talk, let's I guess first it would be wise to illustrate what he did to oust Rupert Lowe. It should also be said that he's done this, Nigel Farage has done this to many, many people before Rupert Lowe. It was staggering. Because, first of all, there was Ben Habib, and then Rupert Lowe. And around that time, people started talking about all the previous instances of this, where someone close to Nigel Farage has been a bit too successful, and so he has ousted them. He's destroyed them. But in the case of Rupert Lowe was extraordinary. It wasn't just that he ousted him from the party. It was much, much more dramatic than that. And you have to wonder, why was it so much more dramatic? But I think it was because he knew that even outside Reform, Rupert Lowe could continue to show him up. So therefore, it had to be a general character assassination. Couldn't just be that he was out of the party. He had to try to destroy his credibility, his reputation. And so he did. So he did everything he could. And it was an amazingly multi-pronged attack on this man. So he accused him of, well, rather, Faraci's assistant, Zia Yusuf, a Sri Lankan Muslim, and I'm sure working in concert with Nigel Farage, accused Rupert Lowe of assaulting him or threatening to assault him, which is just ludicrous. I mean, Rupert Lowe is in his late 60s. Zia Yusuf is in his late 30s. I mean, come on, it's absurd. He also, there were rumors of that some sort of impropriety with female staff. I don't think it was specifically said that it was sexual harassment, but there was some sort of, it was very much vague hints and allegations kind of thing. Then they also accused him of saying, "I will destroy anyone who gets in my way." Which I think, again, is just absurd. I just cannot imagine Rupert Lowe saying those words. And then they also accused him of, they said that he seems to be showing the signs of early dementia. So they accused him of having dementia. I think that's all that they accused him of. Off the top of my head, I can't remember any other things, but it was a general attack. They also said that he wasn't a team player, which again, I think is just unbelievable. This guy's had a very successful career in business and sport, football, and charity. What are the odds that he's not a good team player? It's absurd.
You know, not being a team player when you have a narcissist for a boss is just code for cutting off the boss's narcissistic supply, basically, which goes back to the bad character of Nigel Farage. He cannot allow anybody around him who shows him up in any way. He always has to be the smartest guy in the room. He's always got to be the star. And of course, that is a terrible limitation to his party because, frankly, a successful party might require more talented people than Nigel Farage. Old Nige might not be the be-all and end-all. He might not be what's needed to save Great Britain.
Absolutely. You're obviously going to need a team of people. And this has been a cause for some anxiety over the last year or so, especially since he got rid of Rupert Lowe. He has really brought the party down in several ways. He's cucked it in several ways. But another way is that he's, for example, refused to bring in talent. He doesn't seem to have been recruiting talented people and bringing them into the party. They've not come up with policy. They've not come up with a plan. It's just all him. It's Nigel. It's the Nigel Farage show. So therefore, of course, it's going to be a success. And the thing is, that sounds absurd, but I think it actually does work with some people. I think a lot of people really enjoy this idea of the showman who will get things done. He'll stick it to the wokies and the establishment. But he is the establishment. And this is what I think a lot of people have realized recently, and especially since the Rupert Lowe debacle a year ago. I think it was March last year. So yeah, a year. Yeah, is there anything you want to say about that? I can't, before I move on.
Well, Farage's character, it just strikes me. Okay, he's a consummate narcissist. That's what he comes off as to me. That is reinforced by the pattern of driving away good people. He can't suffer other people around him who might show him up. He wants to play the bad boy. He wants to get revenge on people who snubbed him. He wants to show those people, whoever they are. And then as soon as he gets into a position where he feels like he showed them, then what he's going to do is he's going to cuck madly to try and show that he's really a good guy. He's a heckin' good anti-racist kind of guy, right? And of course, this is no more sincere than anything else he does because it's all about him. But he wants to burnish his credentials. He wants people to say, oh, Nigel, he's not so bad. Yeah, he might have defeated these people. Now he's the center of everything. But see, he's not so bad. He's no threat to us. And I've seen this pattern play out on smaller scales with other, you know, sort of teacup narcissists in my life. And here I am seeing it playing out on a much grander scale. And it would be laughable if it weren't the case that Great Britain needs somebody to save it, not some guy who's going to go in there and become the center of dissident energies, create a lot of, create a big splash, you know, get press, cause upset, and then do nothing, just waste it all, because ultimately it was only about him getting to play the bad boy.
Yeah, yeah, he wants to be the enfant terrible, but not so terrible that he doesn't have respectability and access to the establishment. So mm-hmm. that means he simply cannot be very effectual at all. Mm-hmm. And all of his promises are destined to come to nothing.
Imagine him having all of his talents and not caring about the opinions of his enemies, not thinking that his enemies' opinions grant him moral sanction. He would be a formidable force. But because he cares deeply what the people who hate him ultimately think about him, because he thinks that he can be the bad boy and then sort of wash himself in the blood of the lamb by being anti-racist in the end, by putting some Muslim here and a Muslim there and a black man there. You know, it's like every college catalog cover. That just makes him a completely worthless figure because principles matter. And if he's got the wrong principles, if he's got the wrong moral principles, if he quakes in fear at the thumb, you know, the finger coming down and saying racist, to borrow a phrase from from Jonathan Bowden, then he's useless to us. And one of the things that Lowe did that I thought was wonderful is he said, if that makes me racist, so what? That's a moral yes. revolution right there.
Yeah, it smashes down a wall. It was fantastic. And he said that several times, I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. And it's great. It's wonderful to hear. But I think I should list some things that Nigel Farage has done with Reform UK since he ousted Rupert Lowe, just to illustrate how depressing the situation was just a week ago before Rupert Lowe made this announcement. Oh, I should say that after he was ousted, because some people don't seem to understand this. Understand, why would you if you're not in Britain? So I'll just lay this out. After getting ousted, Rupert Lowe founded an organization, and a lot of people were goading him to start his own party, but he didn't want to. And he said that he thought the right course of action at this point is to create a sort of campaign organization, a lobby group sort of thing. And so he did, and it was called Restore Britain. That was what he did. And he also did the rape gang inquiry. In the meantime, Nigel Farage completely destroyed whatever promise Reform UK had once had. And he did this in quite a few different ways. He said that there would be, he wasn't for mass deportations. He said it was a political impossibility. And he said that he doesn't care about English ethnicity. And he reinforced that quite just a few days ago. He brought in many Muslims into Reform. So many candidates and Sikhs and all of the rest of it. Just anyone who wasn't white was brought in. And I have to say, it did remind me of Trump in the latter days of his first term, where it seemed to be endless ethnic minorities to prove that he isn't racist, and never talking about white Americans, never naming them. Nigel Farage was very much going down that route and is still going down that route. So it was all these non-white candidates that he brought in. Then, more recently, he brought in a bunch of people, politicians, defecting from the Conservative Party. And these are people who were front and center during the Boris wave, during COVID, and then the Boris wave, and then the Afghan asylum debacle. These are the very people who engineered all of those things. And yet he is welcoming them into reform. Now, and the idea, that this is like Robert Jenrick, Suella Braverman, and so on. And the idea is that these people have since seen the light and they've realized that they made terrible mistakes and they were part of bad maneuvers by the conservative part, the conservative government. But now they're wiser and now they want to do the right thing. Well, first of all, I don't believe that for a second, but even if they did want to do the right thing now, why give them the chance? Why give them the light of day? These people should be in prison. These people are traitors to the country. So I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them, but they don't deserve a second chance. That's the thing. But Nigel Farage expected everyone to be delighted that he was bringing these people in. And it was one defection after another. I can't remember all the names now. Some of them were, you know, squiggly non-English names, because even better, it's not just a Tory defector, but it's a brown Tory defector. I mean, how farcical could it be? So that was going on. And actually, the popularity ratings fell for reform after he did this. And this is just a couple of weeks ago now. But polls came out showing that it had really fallen in the rankings. Well, of course. Because this isn't what the British people want. They don't want these particular political traitors, but they also don't want ethnic minorities. They want a party that represents them and stands for them, stands for their interests. Nigel Farage, I don't think, takes this seriously at all. I just don't think he's a serious man. But it's worse than that, because there's a dark side to it. He's a narcissist. So that was it, the Tory defectors. And then another thing he did recently was he, for no reason, like just out of the blue, he spoke out against working from home, which I think is just mental, because, I mean, you and I work from home, obviously. We're a bit biased about this. But it has become a thing. And, you know, if you could say that the COVID era did one bit of good, it was probably this, that it promoted a lot more of working from home. And so people no longer have to do a tedious commute into an office. So that simplifies all the sorts of things in their lives. And they don't have to get childminders and all the rest of it. So a lot of people really like working from home. And for some reason, Nigel Farage chose to speak out against that. And I remember somebody comment, I can't remember who it was, sorry, I'm not giving you credit, but somebody else commented in speech marks saying, "My funders are big into commercial real estate."
Yeah, that could be it. I mean, that could very well be it. The other thing is that a lot of oligarchs just feel like they're not getting their money's worth unless they've got people standing over you looking at you. But honestly, there are ways that they can ensure the quality of work without having somebody standing over and minding you like a child. But yes, if you are heavily invested in commercial real estate, working from home is a terrible thing for your balance sheet. So that's actually a very astute remark.
Yeah, I thought it was it felt significant to me. It just showed where his loyalties lie. It's not with ordinary people. And then finally, two other things that happened recently was the Reform just had a conference, and it had this ridiculous, tacky, I don't know what you'd call this, sort of karaoke, like pub entertainers, pub singers, the kinds of entertainment that you get on a cheap cruise ship or the cross-channel ferry. It's people who are singing old songs from the 70s and whatever. And, you know, it's fine in a working-class pub or something. It's a bit of fun. But to have that at a political conference in a country like Britain, which is in a dire state, just shows a completely trivial attitude, I think. This is not, We've got 100,000 girls being raped by Pakistanis. Now isn't the time for a fucking sing-song. It's outrageous that he would do this. It just shows a completely, trivial attitude. That's probably the best way to put it. And I also noted, because I thought, it occurred to me, and I tweeted about this. I said, this isn't something that young people are going to identify with. I mean, even everyone enjoys a sing-song, sure, but this type of thing, it was tacky even in the 90s. So it's something that appeals to people of an older generation. Now, again, that's fine, but the significance is that it shows what Nigel Farage is targeting, the age groups, the demographics that he's targeting, are white boomers who don't realize how bad the situation is in the country. A lot of them, and just want a return to the 90s. It seemed to really sum that up. And then somebody replied to my tweet saying he was a member of Reform for a while, and they're constantly doing bingo nights in his town. And so again, this is
very boomer
very much of yes, very much. I mean, this is the English equivalent of the casinos in America where boomers spend all their time, all their money.
And their kids' inheritances, yes.
Exactly. So it just seemed to sum it up. This is not a party that's actually looking at the real situation, and it's not a party that's even trying to appeal to the young. It's a party that is basically trying to keep the boomers asleep by distracting them with nonsense, with ethnic minority candidates so that they can prove they're not racist by disapproving of that, and with bingo. It's just nowhere near what Britain needs right now. And then into that milieu, that was when Rupert Lowe announced Restore Britain. So I wanted to set that stage there because that was the situation just 2 weeks ago. And you can understand why people were depressed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And Lowe's announcement was poles apart from all of this messaging, this boomer-coded frivolity that was coming out from Farage. It seemed almost calculated to throw that in the most unattractive relief. He's just a serious man on his farm saying, we've got a terrible fight. ahead of us. And I thought this is wonderful. He's not flattering them. He's not lulling them to sleep. He's not giving them pie in the sky. He's just laying it out. You know, there's a crisis and we've got to do something about it. And he wasn't exalting himself as some great leader or personality or anything, but he came across as having the right kind of personality here for the time. He was like Cincinnatius on his farm. You know, he was going to be answering the call of his fatherland to set things right. I just thought it was brilliant. If it was calculatedly brilliant, it's still brilliant because it couldn't have created a more dramatic contrast between Farage, who just looks frivolous and self-indulgent by comparison.
Absolutely. Rupert Lowe in that, I agree, it was a very well-judged video. I've been writing an essay about it, and that was the phrase I used. I think it was, I don't know if a professional PR firm was involved in conceiving that video, but either way, I don't think it could have been done better. I think it was great. Showing him on the farm was a good idea because that appeals to the British psyche, the idea of self-sufficiency, the idea of generations, the idea of seasons, the idea of independence, all of that appeals to just a general British psyche. And he also said, he actually explicitly said, what is needed is going to be incredibly painful. And that is the polar opposite of what Nigel Farage does with his fucking bingo nights and all the rest of it. This party atmosphere, fun. It's nonsense. And I loved how different Rupert Lowe's video was from all of that. And then his speech, a lot of people don't know that he also gave a speech. It's you can find it on YouTube. It's like a 20-minute long speech that he gave the next day in Great Yarmouth at his constituency. And it's very well worth listening to as well. And he reiterated there that this is not going to be fun. This is not going to be easy. It's not going to be happy clappy, but we have to rescue our country. We have to rescue our people. We have to ensure a future for our children. He didn't say those words, but that was what he meant. And this is what has been direly, desperately needed for not years, for decades. And I don't know the last time that I had this feeling about, I've never had this feeling about a politician in my life. I've never thought this guy is trustworthy. This guy is good. And he has my best interests at heart. And he cares about the country. He cares about our people. I have never felt that in my lifetime. And so I don't know whether Rupert Lowe is perfect. I'm sure he isn't. But he's a lot better than anything else we've got or anything else we've had for a very long time.
Great. And again, no politician needs to be perfect. That's a straw man. I haven't seen anything yet that gives me pause about his character. And that's the important thing. Again, there are lots of people who are going to come forward with their wonkery and they're going to say, Farage can win. He's electable. But that doesn't matter if he's got the wrong character and the wrong principles. If he's got the wrong principles, he doesn't want the right things. And if he's got the wrong kind of character, he doesn't have the strength to stand up against the establishment and the crazed, ideologically anti-British, anti-white people who have battened onto your country and who have to be told a hard, final no if you're going to save anything. He simply doesn't have the strength to say no to these people, much less fight them, and he would have to fight them. Whereas I see Lowe as clearly somebody who's got that kind of character. He's got the right character and the right principles. Electability doesn't matter if you're not electing a real alternative to the problem. And that's as simple as that. And yes, when these horrible faces like Suella Braverman and Jenrick started coming over, anybody who's the least bit cynical about party establishment politics saw, you know, the game is fixed. The way the two-party or multi-party establishment works is the same people with the same policies remain in power, but in order to maintain democratic legitimacy, they go through a charade of passing power from one party to another. They pass power from one party to another. They differentiate the parties on inessential things while remaining united on the essential stuff that they really care about. And then what they'll do is they will use their failure as basically a way of gaining power. So, you know, the center right gets into power. They don't do what the people want. They do what the oligarchs want. The people get angry. Popular discontent puts the center left in power. And then the center left does the same thing. And then the center right comes back into power. Maybe it's a different brand of center right. Maybe it's Farage. But he doesn't do what the people want. He does what the oligarchs want, the establishment. And then the dissatisfaction just is basically channeled into another round of the center left, and things don't move forward. People see through that. And when the face of Suella Braverman popped up, I think a lot of people said, okay, this guy isn't for us. He's not the real deal. This is just another form of the establishment. Zero seats should be the attitude now towards Farage and his people. Zero seats for the Tories, zero seats for the Tory light, Tory, new Tory. Well, you have new Labour, it's new Tory. That's what reform is now. It's the new Tory party. Zero seats for new Tory.
there was more of a difference between Labour and New Labour than there is between the Conservative Party and Reform UK. There was literally more of a difference. I mean, it was actually a change in attitude, whereas I can't see any difference whatsoever with Reform. Now, the thing is, I actually wrote an essay. I should have just published it last year. I wrote it in September. I finished it in September last year. And for some reason, I didn't publish it. I've no idea why. But it's now sort of out of date because of new developments. And it was about the prospects of a Nigel Farage prime ministership. What should we realistically expect him to do? And my conclusion was nothing. And this was before all of the ethnic minority candidates and definitely before the Tory defections. Even then, I thought that this guy isn't going to do anything. His heart just isn't in it. He's in this for himself. He's not in this for tough battles, and he really doesn't care about the country. So what can you expect him to do in the sense of defying the establishment? Bugger all. So, and that was before all of this stuff. I mean, all of the recent stuff has just confirmed that. So I think you can see why people were and are desperate for an alternative. Now, I agree with you. What people are now saying is, oh, it's splitting the right-wing vote. Now, this is a fairly complicated matter, actually, because they are right. And you might well end up with a Labour-Green Party coalition, Labour-Lib Dem coalition, or even a Tory-Conservative Reform coalition. That might be the outcome here, but I would say that's a price worth paying, because in the next election after that, Restore Britain will probably almost certainly get a majority, and then they'll be able to take power and they won't be compromised. I always remember what happened when the Lib Dem Conservative coalition in 2010, what that actually did was it castrated the Lib Dems, because they were seen to have no power in that coalition, but they were also blamed for all the failures of that coalition. So that's what would happen if Restore Britain didn't get a majority. So I actually think in the long term, it's probably best if they don't win this next election, whenever it is, and then allow the establishment to really just completely destroy what's left of its credibility, including the Green Party, which for now is a sort of unknown quantity in the public's eye, and then win the next election outright. And then they can begin the hard work of actually, well, restoring Britain.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, he's splitting the vote. He's splitting the right-wing vote. You could have said that to Farage. Oh, Nige, you're splitting the right-wing vote. You can't do that. Right.
Yeah.
If you were a Tory, you'd say that you're splitting the right wing vote. At a certain point, though, I think that what Lowe should say is that Farage is splitting the right wing vote. He's splitting the vote, and he needs to get out. Of course.
Yeah.
Because two can play that game, right? Yeah. I mean, what's going on? There's like some peculiar physics of headbutting that I've never quite understood. You know, when some guy in the movie like smashes his head into another guy, you think, isn't that going to hurt them equally? You know, isn't it inflicting equal damage? But somehow, just by throwing the headbutt, you have an advantage, right? Well, what you're doing is you're projecting some kind of momentum. And I think that this sort of thing, you're splitting the white right-wing vote, that's a headbutt. You're saying it first, and therefore you've got some kind of momentum. But no, Lowe just says, look, you're splitting the vote. You need to step aside. I'm the real deal. You're not. Just hold firm on that, because people are already defecting to Lowe. The numbers of people who have signed up in his party, the number of people who are sitting politicians in various councils who have declared for that party is rising. Many, many people see the problems with Farage, and now they have an alternative. I think that despite all the wonk types and the safe bet types saying, oh no, you've got to stay with Farage. The truth is that there is going to be a mass of people coming over, and it's going to happen very quickly, and that will take the wind out of the sails of the electability argument. Now, there's something that Martin Sellner said on Telegram that I think is extremely wise and clever, and I want to read this out, and I hope somebody out there can put this in front of Rupert Lowe. Years ago, like 25 years ago or so, I started corresponding with this monk in Bulgaria about some academic topic, right? It was, we were going back and forth, and then he mentioned that he was a monarchist. And I said, oh, I'm very interested in monarchism. And he's saying, oh, yes, the Tsar wants to get back into power. He wants to do this and that. And I said, well, what he really should do is these things. And I listed out a few things that the Tsar should do. And he wrote back and he said, thank you very much. I have forwarded your recommendations to the Tsar. And I thought, you never know who you're talking to, right? You never know how many degrees of separation you are from the Tsar. And so if there's anyone listening who's knows the Tsar of Restore Britain, send this from Martin Sellner along. So it's called Lowe versus Farage, Easy Wins. And I'm just going to read it. Some people ask me how this could work. It is easy, in my opinion. Until now, Farage has been playing politics on easy mode with endless lives. He only has to say, stop the boats, and that was enough. Angry British voters filled the rest themselves. This is the man who will stop Islamization and grooming gangs and ultimately send the migrants home. That ambiguity is now gone. In every confrontation between Lowe and Farage, Restore can win simply by forcing clarity and exposing the gaps. It's not complicated. Farage, I was the first to say stop the boats, and that's been my clear line ever since. Lowe, what about the boats that have already arrived? Do you support mass deportations as outlined in our plan? Farage, basically crickets, right? Lowe, Mr. Farage, do you agree that there is an ongoing replacement of the English culture and an Islamization of Britain, including through legal immigration? Farage, crickets. Lowe, Mr. Farage, considering grooming gangs, child marriages, and halal slaughter, do you really believe Islam is an integral part of Britain and that this diversity makes us stronger? What can Farage say to these things? It goes on. These are just examples that come to mind within 2 minutes. Give it a full day of research. Identify every pressure point where Farage has distanced himself from hard positions. Frame those issues in clear, popular language, then make him clarify and backpedal again and again. With every encounter, Farage's image as rebel weakens. The tiger begins to look like a domesticated kitten, while Rupert Lowe positions himself as the lion of mass deportations. Lowe has no centrist voter base to protect. I think that's an important point. No foreign candidates to appease. He can move freely and aggressively as long as he doesn't make the same mistakes and weigh himself down like that Farage has done. Farage, by contrast, is constrained, cautious, and despite his performance, deeply wary of losing ground. I think these are very, very good points from Sellner, and I think that this is how basically Lowe could just dismantle Farage, because Farage, like he says, stop the boats and people fill in all the rest. But he doesn't fill in all the rest. He doesn't want to do all the rest. Lowe wants to do all the rest. And if Lowe shows that Farage is a phony, he's a poser, he doesn't want to follow through, whereas Lowe will do the job, I think that's going to make a huge difference, and there's just going to be a flood of the best people, not the bingo players, not the minority candidates, but the best people are going to flood from Reform to Restore. I think I think that's inevitable. Now, there's one thing I want to talk about, and that was the remarkable document that they released shortly after announcing the party, Mass Deportations, : Legitimacy, Legality, and Logistics. This was brought out by Lowe and other members of Restore Britain. It is an extensive document. It's 113 pages long, and it lays it out very beautifully. Basically, it falls into two large categories. One, the legal obstacles to mass deportations and how they can be overcome. Boom. He lays it all out. They have a complete roadmap of all the things standing in the way of mass deportations and what they would do to remove those obstacles. And then two, practical logistics of mass deportations. That's all worked out extremely well, too. I don't want to go into the details, but there's one thing in it that I thought was extraordinarily interesting, and that is under the heading of, I think it's under the heading of restoring the judicial system. Basically, what he says is that there needs to be what he calls a Great Clarification Act. Britain is blessedly without a written constitution. It has a parliamentary sovereignty, and the parliament can simply come forward and declare certain things to clarify what the constitution really means. And he says there needs to be a great clarification that it is the parliament that is sovereign and that judicial activism is not a thing anymore in Great Britain. There cannot be judges popping up and contradicting national policy by appealing to some European Human Rights Court settlement or some international treaty or whatever. That obstructionism ends. And he said there needs to be a clarification of the constitutional relationship between the parliament and the judiciary. And there needs to be a mechanism whereby judicial activism can be shot down in real time. Boom, boom, boom. Every time this comes up, it's simply vacated. That, I think, is very canny because we're looking at, in the United States, what's happening with Trump. Trump is being stymied by judicial activism at every turn. It would require a constitutional amendment to fix this problem. In the UK, it only requires a clarification. And it might be very difficult to get that. But the fact that they're thinking in those terms, they're thinking in fundamental terms about what has to be done, I think is very important. This is why I started thinking this guy needs to be Lord Protector. He needs to get plenary powers to just clear away the obstacles, clear them out, clear out the migrants, clear out the obstructionists, clear out the laws, clear out the treaties, clear it all out and save the country. So I was very impressed with this. There's not a peep of any of this kind of far-thinking and fundamental strategizing in the Farage camp. Not a peep of this kind of stuff. This is a serious man with a serious party. And this is the kind of political thinking that I find really inspiring.
Oh, I completely agree. There's just a completely different attitude on show. Restore Britain have actually been releasing policy documents for recently. And even as a campaign group, they were coming up with ideas for a policy. Reform as an actual party weren't doing that. So, as far as I know. So, you've got a completely different attitude here. One other thing I wanted to bring up from earlier was that the distinction, and this is where Nigel Farage again completely falls flat, the distinction between legal and illegal migrants. He will say that we need to reduce illegal migration. But legal immigration is untouchable for him. Well, that's not nearly good enough because the majority of the damage being done to our demographics is through legal migration. But just the difference between migration being legal or illegal is simply policy. It's just what does the government decree? It's ridiculous. But this is the situation that we're in. So. But Restore Britain and Rupert Lowe don't have this hang-up at all. They're quite willing to say, a lot of legal migrants have to go as well. Because what matters is the people of this country. And again, just to hear that phrase, you know, the British people, the people of Britain, it's unusual in this day and age, you know, because politicians speak about economies, they speak about infrastructure, public services, but they don't speak about the people and values, of course, but they don't speak about the actual demo, like who we are. Mm-hmm. And this is why I loved it in Rupert Lowe's video where he said, Britain is not just an economic zone. It is a home. It is a homeland.
This is one of the most important things that J.D. Vance said when he was running, that America is not just an economic zone. It's the homeland of a people. Another thing that Lowe said that I thought was wonderful is that just because you have a British passport doesn't make you British. That is gone. That is a barrier that has now been set aside. It was a weak, silly barrier, but somebody like Farage won't cross that line. He just blew right through it. Now, if anybody thinks about it for 30 seconds, they can say, yes, I can agree with that. It's a taboo that's been shredded and it can't be defended. I don't think people will successfully defend that. Oh, well, they've got their papers in order. That was always a tissue thin pretext. And now that's gone. So this is a very, very positive change. I want to say two things about this. Just like Trump in 2015, when he announced his candidacy and said that he was going to run on questioning the goodness of mass migration and economic globalization. Just like Trump, simply by stating that, created a revolution in America. It was an earthquake because he simply threw aside a couple of the establishment's dogmas. Everybody in the establishment had this agreement that, yes, they would compete on things like abortion or flags or whatever, right? Trans your kids, whatever. But they weren't going to compete on immigration and globalization. They had a gentleman's agreement not to compete on that. Trump just tore that up. That has changed American politics since then, and it is not going to be bent back to the old system, no matter how much they would like to try. In the same way, Lowe, simply by laying this all out and saying, I don't care if they call me racist, they have paperwork that doesn't make them British. Here's a plan to not just stop them, but remigrate them. Not just the illegals, but legals as well. If he can't deliver on that, somebody else will come along to deliver on that. Because once the people realize, yes, this is what we want, and there are actual people who are going to give us what we want, they're not going to easily go back to liberal democracy, the establishment liberal democracy game, which is basically just a masterpiece at never giving the people what they want. So this is very important. Even if Lowe isn't the man to carry this through, simply by putting this out there, he's going to whet people's appetites for the real thing, and somebody is going to come along and carry it through. So that's the first point I want to make. And the second point is that we don't know how he's going to carry things forward with his party, right? It's not clear. But I think it's very, very important for him to build a cadre of people around him. This cannot be like Nigel Farage, the Rupert Lowe show. This can't be the Rupert Lowe show. This has to be something more serious. Because Lowe is 68 years old, it might take 10 years before his people control the government. He'll be an old man by then. That would be a shame, because as we've seen, old politicians, they get weaker, right? They lose their edge. He needs to start building a cadre of people around him and a deep bench and people who can take over after him. And because he's evidently not a giant narcissist, he would actually be capable of fostering such people. Narcissists can't train their replacements because they're threatened by them, right? Whereas healthy people will train their replacements, because what they're really thinking about is not themselves. They're thinking about the country. They're thinking about the mission. They're thinking about instituting their principles. And if he thinks that way, if he truly thinks that way, I would really like to see signs that he's building that kind of structure in his party, because that means that even if he doesn't carry these ideas into power, somebody else will come up behind him and carry these ideas into power.
Yeah, I agree. That is a genuine concern, because we don't know when the next election is even going to be. It might be 2029, in which case he'll be, 71 by then. And then it'd be 75 when it finished. I mean, it's not ancient, but it's not ideal. But the thing is, he is deliberately, he's very conspicuously surrounding himself with younger, like much younger men in their 20s and 30s. So I think that's a terrific sign. And you've heard me moan before about the preponderance of old men, especially in American politics, and how it just seems morbid. It just seems unhealthy. I'll never forget that footage of, was it Mitch McConnell apparently having a stroke during a press call? I mean, that was astonishing. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing just shouldn't be happening. Mm-hmm. Mind you, we've got our own version of this. There's an 81-year-old woman who is apparently the top choice to head Ofcom in Britain. It just seems insane to me that you would put an 81-year-old, especially a woman, in charge of freedom of speech. I mean, that's unbelievable. But apparently she is the number one choice just now. So mm-hmm. It's here as well in Britain. And I do think it's unhealthy, especially because in this day and age, older people don't tend to realize how bad the situation is in the country. So This is why it's another great sign with Rupert Lowe, that he's had the sense to surround himself with young men, with energetic people. So I think that's great. And one of them, no doubt, will rise to prominence and become his successor in time. I think he's doing this with that in mind.
Good. I'm encouraged to hear that. Folks, if you would like to ask Millennial Woes or me questions, we love questions, but we have a slight favor towards Super Chat questions. If you want to send a donation in, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, no hyphen. It's scrolling across the bottom of your screen like a ticker tape. Go there, take out your plastic, and send us a donation. We will get to your questions before the end of the stream. And I'll give Woes a minute to think about some new things and reset, and I will actually run through a few people and just thank them. So Isaiah has sent $11.50. Thank you very much. Archie sends $14.88. A little bit of cash. Thanks, Entropy. Thank you, Archie. Appreciate it. Concerned Future writes in with $10. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Hi, Greg. It's been a while since I donated. And with the Olympics going on now, I figured I'll ask a sports ball question. Who are you rooting for in the men's hockey final, Team USA or Canada? Well, this is a question that there's a line straight down my heart, in the middle of my heart, between Canada and the United States, because I have a Canadian side to my family. Honestly, I haven't watched it, but when I think hockey, I think of Canada. So I'll be rooting for the Canadians in this. It's my reparations as an American to Canada for all the nonsense that they've had to suffer at the hands of our current president. All this stuff about 51st state and all the tariffs and stuff like that. I'm going to be rooting for the Canadians in hockey. I think that that's not unreasonable. Let's see if there are any other questions here or just donations. All righty. Well, I do have a question here by email from one of our longtime listeners and supporters, Sutton. And Sutton wants Millennial Woes to share his thoughts about the recent arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Woes, do you have any thoughts about that?
I think that he's the fall guy for everyone else involved with the Epstein files, most of whom are Jewish. And I've no doubt that, I mean, I have no evidence that he's been involved with perverted stuff, but it doesn't surprise me. And I'm not going to defend him and be outraged at this, that the suggestion that he's involved with that kind of stuff. I don't deny it. I don't know. I just think it's interesting that so much attention is falling on him rather than all the others.
Yeah, this is in the same country where, say, the Daily Mail and the other major newspapers are reporting that Epstein was working for foreign intelligence for Russia. Okay, that's another cover-up, too. That's clearly a deflection. This is the establishment deflecting. Is this another deflection? Well, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, I think, clearly was involved with Epstein. So is his ex-wife, sadly. There's a lot of stuff in their correspondence where he's talking about arrange a little thing with one of your inappropriate friends, teehee. Clearly something like that's going on. But let's not lose sight of this. The thesis that people like me have maintained for a long time is that Epstein had ties to foreign intelligence, Mossad, basically. First of all, Epstein is a very, was a very ethnocentric, hyper-conscious Jew. And for any Jew like that, treason is just a phone call away. If Israeli intelligence called any highly ethnocentric Jew in any position in society, from financier to dog catcher, and said, Israel needs a favor, most of them would say yes. There's no question about it. That said, he had very close ties to the Israeli establishment, Israeli prime ministers, former prime ministers, etc. Such close ties would raise red flags in the United States if you were doing a background check for a job. If you were a Chinese national with close ties to people in the Chinese political establishment, you would not be able to get a security clearance. Well, maybe you would, but you shouldn't. These are the kinds of things that raise red flags. There are all kinds of ample red flags that he has Israeli intelligence connections. That's the main thing that bothers me. The hanky-panky, right? All of that strikes me as just the honeypot, right? To get people compromised. Why? So they can be exploited. For what purposes? Shaking them down financially, getting them to invest things here and there, right? Beyond that, share secrets. That's what the goal of this was. And Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor was not arrested for kiddie-diddling. He was arrested for sharing state documents with Epstein. Now, it surprises me that this, I thought he was frankly just sort of a goofball, would have any access to any important documents whatsoever. But apparently he had access to information that a foreign intelligence agent would like to get a hold of. And so I look at this and I think this is very much at the heart of what people like me have been saying about the Epstein problem. This was an intelligence gathering operation that used compromat on powerful and influential and highly connected figures in order to basically subvert them and turn them into intelligence assets, basically, informants, traitors. I think he could have committed treason. And frankly, if we had a serious monarchy, Charles would hand him a pistol and say, go do the honorable thing with an OU. The honorable thing. And that's what he should do. Because if he is actually involved in treason, I don't know, is it still a serious crime to betray your country in the UK? I would hope so. It definitely seems to be that if it's a member of the royal family betraying the country, that's a very serious thing.
Yeah, very. And I'm hoping that this... it will also be judged very seriously in the case of Peter Mandelson, who it seems was giving away state secrets to Epstein, and is just all round a sinister figure. He's been involved with one scandal after another throughout his career. It's incredible that he keeps coming back. But I think this is it now. I mean, this has to be it now for him.
He's a member of a highly connected network group with a universal backstage pass, and they always seem to fail upwards. Mandelson, if he has shared state secrets, should be tried for treason. I would like to see some treason trials here. I think that that would be very, very important. It's very interesting. Heads of Roland, well, not literally yet, but people have resigned in Europe and in the UK. Nobody's resigned from anything except for Goldman Sachs and a couple of other business concerns in the United States. Nobody in government has resigned yet because of this, but I'm hoping that that'll happen eventually. But America is the most shameless country on the planet, frankly, and it's going to take a whole lot before some of these gold-plated rotters resigns. So yeah, that we have a I think we've got a longer road to hoe before any of these people actually resign, but I think it's going to happen. And the fact that it's happening in Europe now, I think is encouraging. It certainly makes the Europeans look like more serious people than the Americans. I want America to catch up.
Well, yeah, America was more... Epstein was more central to America, let's say, whereas in Britain, he was an outsider. So... to some extent, there's more leeway here in investigating at least his accomplices, his marks, if not him himself.
Yeah, he had Queen Elizabeth's phone number, right? Yes. She was in his address book. That, I think, is interesting. And so he had hooks into the royal family. That is very high up. Also, Ghislaine Maxwell, her father... Robert Maxwell was, of course, he was from Central Europe, like Slovakia, I think, a Jew. Original name is something like Benjamin Hawk. Became Robert Maxwell, became a publisher in the United Kingdom. And he was very much established, involved with the British establishment. And of course, anything that he heard of any interest went straight to Israeli intelligence. He embezzled £450 million in the late 80s. A lot of money then. And then he died not long after that, probably murdered, people suspect. And interestingly enough, Epstein believed that he was murdered by the Israelis for trying to shake them down to basically cover the money that he had stolen. I don't know why he couldn't just put it back himself. Maybe it got invested in various things. There's all these questions about where Epstein's money came from. I think his money could very well have come from the stolen hundreds of millions of pounds that were absconded with by Maxwell. Ghislaine Maxwell was his girlfriend and co-conspirator. She's the only other person who's gone to jail so far because of all this stuff. And when Robert Maxwell was offed and fished out of the Mediterranean, he was flown off to Israel and given basically a state funeral. The president of Israel was there. The prime minister of Israel was there. A future prime minister of Israel was there. The head of Israeli intelligence was there. And the five previous heads of Mossad were also there. The president of Israel gave the eulogy at his funeral. This guy was hyper-connected with the Israeli establishment, and his daughter shows up, becomes Jeffrey Epstein's girlfriend. Jeffrey Epstein has suddenly this vast amount of money, and he's engaged, and he's living this James Bond lifestyle, complete with extremely dissolute behavior, wining and dining, and other stuff with people like Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Gets the Queen's number in his book, is a big friend of Fergie, and so on and so forth. So he's got his hooks in the British establishment too. The people that he had the most connection with were the British establishment, Israel, and the US establishment, and then these various sheikhs, you know, Gulf Sheikh types. He didn't have all that much connection in Europe, although he had some. And he was, you know, very little in the Far East. But the UK was definitely one of his frequent stopover points, and he had a lot of contacts there. So I'm hoping that in the United States, this is going to seriously shake up our political establishment, and I hope it shakes up your political establishment too.
Yeah, I agree. To me, it's obvious that just on a common sense level, Epstein was, it was a blackmailing operation funded by Mossad and Israel and all the rest of it. It was operating on behalf of Israel for Israel's interests. Of course it was. And of course he didn't get rich, like massively, massively rich out of nowhere. I think he was a maths teacher for like 2 years or something in the 70s. And then suddenly he's in high society and making massive amounts of money and then buying an island. I mean, it's preposterous. And there are some people who think that, well, this wasn't anything shady. It wasn't anything serious. It was just fun for the wealthy. It was just prostitutes. He was a facilitator, but he wasn't a black. Well, then why wasn't he a blackmailer? I mean, it's crazy to be in that position, to be highly connected to Mossad, but you're not blackmailing these people. Come on, it's ridiculous. The only question for me is, to what extent was it pedophilia and the whole Pizzagate stuff?
Yeah.
Was it just prostitutes that maybe at the edge of legality, 17 years old, or was it kids? Was it 7-year-olds? That's the only ambiguity as far as I can see.
Right. And the other thing is that the blackmail angle is only a small part of the control. And it may never have been invoked at any point. What happens is he got to be very chummy with these people. And once he got very chummy with these people, he would start probably asking them for favors, asking them for inside info and stuff like that. And he might never have said, oh, by the way, if you don't give this to me, I've got this on you. But in the back of their minds, they knew that. And they were probably quite willing to help him out. They probably didn't need coercion. But once he had gotten them in to all of this stuff, they felt like even if they had a twinge of conscience and wanted to back out, they realized they couldn't. So the blackmail thing doesn't have to be so vulgar as them threatening you. And they may never have been threats, but it was always there in the back of their minds because they had implicated themselves, inculpated themselves in various criminal things. And the most serious crimes that these people might have committed were not even, you know, statutory rape. They probably committed espionage multiple times. My sense is that Bill Clinton probably betrayed his country over and over again. I mean, betraying your country with the Israelis is practically in a, you know, it's practically a requirement for any American political figure. It's a routine treason that gets them in the door. But that's the thing that I think was going on. The crimes that they were most worried about covering up probably had to do with espionage, the lower end insider trading, violation of certain fiduciary duties, that kind of stuff. But they were whoring around and partying with this guy. And yeah, some of them probably did engage in statutory rape. And some of them probably knew it. And the Pizzagate stuff, there's enough of that code language in there to be very suspicious. And there are enough pictures of him with obviously very young children to make that extremely suspicious. So at the very least, reasonable minds want to know more about this. But again, we can't allow people to get this sort of off in the weeds with all the salacious stuff. The really serious problem was this was a an Israeli agent with access to very high-level people who had networked with them, buddied up with them, and was probably running them as information sources. And if they had ever tried to back out, the treason would have come out, but there could have been other stuff that they had committed, including crimes of a sexual nature that would have made them think, I can't really do this. Now, others, you know, look at somebody like Bill Gates. This is profoundly embarrassing for Bill Gates. If Epstein had tried to put the screws to him, you know that Bill Gates could not have said no to this, to spare himself the embarrassment that he's now going through. So I do think that blackmail was involved, but it may never have actually gone to that vulgar level. He had so much control over these people, and that was by design. That was his whole scheme. You know, I saw somebody in your chat saying, well, ha ha, Prince Andrew was arrested for sharing state secrets, not pedophilia. Take that. It's like, wait a second here. You've lost the plot here. the espionage is far more serious than the girls. That's I think something that we can't lose sight of.
Yeah, of course. The whole thing is seedy. And obviously this is the kind of thing that elites get up to and always have got up to. But in this case, it was under the control, the auspices of a foreign power, a very devious foreign power. And I think it's exactly what it looks like. And I agree with you that it probably never had to be explicit. Probably only on rare occasions did he have someone so autistic that they didn't understand the predicament they were in and he had to spell it out for them.
Do I have to be so vulgar, you know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, only somebody like Elon would be that autistic, and they thought he was too much of a nerd to come to the island anyway. So anyway,
yeah.
I have a few more questions here. A disembodied voice sends $5. Thank you. Rupert Lowe is an old Tory type. He was a banker and made millions. He could be our man on the inside. He thinks outside the box. He is a doer. He is the kind of guy who is probably on course for a CBE or knighthood, but has burned that bridge now. Well, he'll just have to become Lord Protector and get all that stuff later. He'll be a Knight of the Garter before this is over, if King William has any lick of sense in his head. Disembodied voice continues with $10 more. Lowe represents the nationalist side of the Tories, which is always there. The Monday Club, Bowden Powell, the pro-apartheid campaign, and gray area people like the now somewhat disgraced Neil Hamilton. Farage has come to champion the liberal side of the Tories, despite his obvious NF priors, I guess National Front priors. And then he sends $3 more and continues. Lowe is also a bit of a libertarian. In as far as that's even a viable viewpoint in the UK, he is low tax and so on, but he is good enough for now. That stuff comes second to demographics. Anyway, let me just say something about this and we'll pass it to you, Woz. I wanted to get into this, so thank you. I wanted to talk about his philosophy. He does seem to be something of a libertarian. He quotes Ayn Rand from time to time. Okay, let me say one thing about that. I used to quote Ayn Rand from time to time. I used to be something of a libertarian. A lot of people went down a pipeline from libertarianism and objectivism to racial nationalism, and he could have made that journey himself. If he's still partly in a somewhat classical liberal economic mindset, okay, that's not a terrible thing. If you want to calm down the boomers, that would actually be a good thing, to calm them down, right? To make them unafraid. And he understands, though, that whatever capitalism is in his idea, he doesn't stand for global capitalism with no borders. And that's the issue. Capitalism in one country within the bubble of borders, within the bubble of the state, is a perfectly fine and a defensible position. And if that's what he's going for, that's fine. I don't think he's the kind of guy who'd be like Donald Trump every other day. Donald Trump, depending on the last lobbyist or last oligarch he golfed with, will be saying things like, our industries need illegal aliens. No, I don't think that Lowe is going to be that wobbly on that kind of stuff. I think that he clearly understands that the nation and its borders and its identity come first. And if he's got sensibly conservative, low tax views, that's fine, because you do have to appeal, especially with boomers, to those kinds of considerations as well, not to frighten them off. So he could be sort of a Hayekian boomer whisperer, right? To get some of these people on board, but deliver the most important thing on borders and remigration and so forth. That's my hope. It's perfectly within the realm of the possible. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I agree. I think that he's a libertarian in the sense that he doesn't like political correctness. He doesn't like DEI. He doesn't like the wokery. I saw a thing with him late last year where he referred to political correctness as all this nonsense and poppycock, which I loved. Very old-fashioned sort of phrase. But I think he's that kind of right-winger. I think that's what he means when he says a libertarian. He doesn't like people being interfered with in their day-to-day lives with alien nonsense that they don't understand and that has nothing to do with them and that is contrary to common sense, etc. When it comes to economics, I think he's pretty good so far from what I've seen. I think, as I said in the earlier in the video, he says Britain is not just an economic zone, it's a home. They've put out a policy document about restoring the British pub. And there are other signs, there are little things where this just seems like a man who has a soul. This is a point that I've made in my essay, which I'm going to publish tomorrow. He doesn't seem like someone who's so obsessed with money and efficiency and numbers that he loses sight of what matters in life. And he specifically said he wants to incentivize people to have families. And he said just a few days ago that he doesn't want BlackRock, I don't want Larry Fink buying up Britain. And that is a crucial thing. I mean, it's such an obvious common sense thing to say, but it's something that politicians don't say nowadays, that we don't want to fucking sell Britain by the pound. This is our homeland. This is our home. It doesn't have a price tag, and it shouldn't have a price tag. And we shouldn't be giving it up to powers that aren't us and that don't have our interests at heart, who don't understand us and our way of life, who have a completely different attitude from ours. And again, this is just common sense. A people should own their country. I mean, this is why it's inherently depressing when you hear that some iconic British company is actually owned by some multinational nowadays, so owned by some conglomerate, like Cadbury's chocolate, for example. But you can go down the list. I mean, so many of them are no longer actually British owned. And it's depressing. It's not how it should be. I think people, maybe this is a British thing, people really like the idea of a family-owned company. They really like the idea of a company that belongs to a city or a town, and certainly to a country. And I think that Rupert Lowe understands this and feels exactly the same way that I do about it. He doesn't want Larry Fink, BlackRock, owning British land, and he probably, almost certainly, doesn't want them owning British companies either, and certainly not the British people.
Well said. Nico has written in and wants us to comment on the fact that he has proposed to ban halal and kosher slaughter. I think that's very interesting. Somehow that breezed right by me. Is that correct?
This is an amazing thing, because if you wanted to make life hard for yourself from the off as a politician, you would say this. And he's gone and done it. You know, he didn't say that he wanted to ban halal. He said, we want to ban halal and kosher. He was very explicit about it. Now, and people have said this is actually going to be more inconvenient for Jews than for Muslims, because Muslims, a lot of them don't adhere to this anyway, and they can import stuff from abroad, Whereas for some reason, Jews can't do that. So I've heard. I don't know if that's true. But either way, it doesn't really matter. It is going to inconvenience Jews. And sometimes I wonder, is he naive? Does he not know what he's setting himself up for when he says something like that? And how long will it last? You know, will the thumbscrews sort that out, or will he persist with it? I hope he does persist with it, obviously. But the point is that it shows that at this point in time, he is serious about wanting to maintain the dignity of the British people, and that includes not allowing barbaric methods of slaughter in our country. Because again, the British people, and I'm sure this goes for other countries as well, but I can speak certainly for the British people, we do not like barbaric slaughter. I mean, it's just, it's grotesque, and there's no need for it. There's no argument in favor of it, except, you know, desert mumbo jumbo. So, which not many of us are amenable to. So it's ridiculous that we tolerate this in our country. And all it needs is a politician, a prime minister, to say this isn't going to happen anymore. And the British people would absolutely go along with that. You're not going to have, you know, even the cucks who say, I've got a black friend and whatever, even they are not going to say, yeah, actually, we should let them slaughter animals in this disgusting, inhumane way because, well, we don't want to be racist. You know, no one is going to say that. The only people who are going to argue with this are Muslims and Jews. Mm-hmm. And by doing so, they show that they don't fit in here, which is, you know, it's kind of fatal for them, actually.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's very important to reassert your cultural standards, which is basically the end of multiculturalism. And any way that you can do that, even things like burqa bans and so forth, I think is very important. Saying, look, we can't have first cousin marriages in this country. We can't have burqas. We can't have Islamic courts. We can't have Islamic slaughter, this kind of stuff. It's just the kind of behavior you expect from a healthy people that's done apologizing for its existence. And you go through this thing with diversity, and it's like the initial diversity appeal is, well, why can't you just be open a little to some exotic things from the rest of the world? And you say, okay, I'll dip my toe in and see what it's like. But at a certain point, it becomes apparent that no, there's only one direction here, and it's always at your expense. And there's never a peep of, say, the British government, Labour government, saying to its Muslim constituencies, hey, why don't you try out some exciting new Western ways of doing things, like not cutting off the parts of your children's bodies and stuff like that. They never say that. They never say it even as like a fun, new, frivolous thing that you might try to add to the diversity of your life. They don't do that at all. It's just a thin edge of a wedge using your openness and tolerance to basically replace your country and your culture. And any healthy society is going to say no to that. And once you start saying no, you realize, wait, we've stopped the multicultural thing. Even demanding assimilation, even though we don't want them to assimilate, but to demand that they assimilate is a healthy sign. And what you hope is that they say, no, we're not going to assimilate. We're headed back to Lahore or wherever. But even demands for assimilation, I think we should regard as healthy signs.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the time to do this was 50 years ago, 70 years ago, in fact, which is astonishing when you think about it, that all of our lives, this has been going on. But yeah, better late than never. And as other people have said, if we assert these things one by one, more and more non-whites will voluntarily leave the country because it's just becoming onerous to stay here. And so we won't have to, forcibly deport them or whatever. They'll just leave of their own volition. which would be great. And that in turn lessens the load for later on when you come to actually deporting people en masse.
Yeah, the report that they released talked about using a variety of tactics, including deportations, but especially soft measures to simply reverse all the economic incentives that have brought them here so they leave. And that includes things like taxing remittances and so forth. But you can also put the screws to them culturally by simply saying, we have our standards. We're not going to call it permise anymore. We're not going to change, either assimilate or leave. A lot of them will leave. So one thing I want to talk about before our time is up, and this has been a very good conversation, is another remarkable thing that happened a little more than a week ago was Marco Rubio, somebody that I never had much interest in or admiration for, at the Munich Security Conference gave a pretty fantastic speech. And there are a few things that stood out about this. First of all, I thought that it was very clearly a change in Trump administration direction. Trump having messed up terribly our relationships with Europe and Canada by shooting his mouth off about things like, you know, seizing land in Greenland and going on about how NATO were a bunch of parasites and NATO had never done anything for the United States, on and on and on. These were crazy. Sometimes some of these statements were false, blatantly false. He seems to have never learned or to have forgotten that the only time NATO's Article 5 was ever invoked in the history of NATO was by the United States the day after the September 11th attacks. And Europe was there for us. And European soldiers went off and fought in Afghanistan and Iraq and died. He never learned it or he forgot. A lot of Europeans knew that and were deeply offended by this. And I think that what Rubio did was he went into the Munich Security Conference, the same conference that J.D. Vance spoke at last year and created a great deal of controversy. Vance basically called out the European governments for violating the freedom of speech of their people and by suppressing populism. And that was a very, very good thing that he did. Anyway, what Rubio did is he tried to lay out, he laid it out very beautifully. America is an offshoot of Europe. Europe is our spiritual homeland. It's where we all come from. It's where our people come from. It's where our culture come from. No mention of Africa or anything like that. Europe. It was a Eurocentric thing. It was an American love letter to Europe. We stand with Europe. Our destiny, our sources are common. We have a common destiny. We want Europe to be strong. We want Europe to be proud of itself, of its identity. And we want Europe to cut out the race replacement, cultural destruction, migration that's going on. And the thing that was so interesting to me is that there were a lot of even libtards in the audience who applauded this, and people around the world, even astonishingly, Hillary Clinton thought this was a good speech. Now, many people don't trust Marco Rubio. I don't trust Marco Rubio. However, the very fact that he said it, even if it's insincere, I thought was extremely significant. I think there was a recognition by more sensible people that America, no matter how strong America is, America plus Denmark, little tiny Denmark, America plus Denmark is stronger than America alone. And America plus Europe is a lot stronger than America alone. You'd think that even a president would understand that, but Trump seems to have lost sight of that, and sensible people recognized that and wanted to repair relationships. Another thing that was very important is he reaffirmed that, yes, we believe in international law. Yes, we think things like the UN and so forth are useful. We don't want to go back to the days before the Second World War before the First World War, when conquest was a right. I thought that was extremely important. And yes, then he shilled a bit for some stupid stuff like kidnapping Maduro and this what obviously seems like a pending war with Iran. But the general tenor of it, I thought, was very encouraging, just from a pro-white point of view and the point of view of somebody like me that wants there to be good relations with Europe and wants the United States to. But I enjoyed the fact that we had a U.S. Secretary of State giving encouragement to anti-migration forces in Europe. If Trump did that, it would harm them. It didn't seem to be that way, the way that Rubio phrased it. And even people like Hillary Clinton were saying, yeah, the migration thing has gotten completely out of hand. So I thought this was a very encouraging speech and something of a sea change. I hope good things come from it.
Yeah, I think it was surprising how amicable it was and how not gung-ho it was in contrast to Trump's speech. I was also surprised at how well received it was, because everyone knows about the audiences at these conferences. There was the bad reception that J.D. Vance got a year ago, people moaning about it, whereas this seems to have gone down very well. I don't know. I don't have much to say about it. I watched the whole thing, and I was impressed by it. I did think it was a bit strange that this, because I've just looked at his background. He is Cuban on both sides, both of his parents. And there was a sense that this isn't quite, I mean, this isn't a sort of WASP American who's saying this stuff, who has a very tangible connection to Britain, to the origins of America. This is a much more modern American than that. But he was saying the kinds of things that you would associate with a WASP American. So I think it was, do you think that Trump approved this speech? Do you think that the people around the administration pushed for a much more conciliatory message after Trump's much more, frankly, offensive message a month ago?
I hope so. I really hope so. There was pushback in the Congress. According to certain reports, there was pushback in the Congress about the Greenland stuff, that there were literally people, Republicans in Congress, saying if they vote to impeach him, we'll vote to convict him. Okay, that was serious, right? And these people might be horrible cucks and have terrible policies on some things, but they understood the basic arithmetic that America plus Europe is stronger than America on its own.
Thing is that Trump didn't need to threaten to seize Greenland or take it over. You know, it was completely unnecessary. Obviously, we do have some of the same interests, and so we are going to be willing to cooperate. You don't need to take us over. It's absurd.
Yeah, and I think it was so out of touch with reality that certain people were thinking he's lost his mind. And therefore, I think that the grateful reception that Rubio's speech received was in part relief that there are cooler heads and sane heads in Washington, D.C. Now, my friend Gadius made this point, which I think is quite valid, that Rubio may be positioning himself to run in 2028 as president. It might not be the sort of thing where Vance is just anointed the candidate. There might actually be a contest there, and Rubio might be positioning himself for that. It's certainly possible. I was impressed by it. And in terms of his own identity, it was very interesting. One of the things that he stressed was that America's cowboy identity was a gift of Spain. And the other thing that he, which is true, and another thing that he emphasized was he talked about his European family roots. In Italy, in Italy as well as Spain. Now, he had to go way, way back, but he knew who his ancestors were, which I thought was really interesting. I found it kind of touching. I actually felt the speech was touching, and it was tugging at the heartstrings of your deep heartstrings of European identity. And I think a lot of the Europeans in the room felt it too. I was surprised by it. And, you know, there's some black woman in a burqa sitting in the middle of it. She didn't look like she was into it at all for obvious reasons. So anyway, I thought it was a positive sign for the Trump administration. I do hope that the damage Trump has done specifically to European identitarians who want to talk about things like remigration has been mitigated somewhat by what Rubio did. Because, like I said, there seemed to be a palpable relief in the room that he had made these statements that they were very conciliatory. And yet, by being conciliatory, I think he was bringing people over to being more receptive to things like, yes, we need to rethink migration. And again, to my astonishment, even somebody like Hillary Clinton was saying that. Of course, she immediately wants to blame the migration on, you know, wascally Republicans looking for cheap labor, which is fine. That's partly true. But it's certainly a lot of it was being pushed by her side of the political spectrum as well. So anyway, I thought overall it was very encouraging.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that Trump, once he's out of the way, hopefully things can proceed in a more healthy footing. I do share the concerns that people have about him, that it's almost as if now that the Jewish lobby have really got their fangs into him, he's rebelling against Europeans out of frustration or anger. I don't know. I don't know what caused that ridiculous. But I'm thinking about the Epstein, his continual denial of the Epstein stuff, and now apparently this oncoming war with Iran, which just seems completely pointless. It's possible that he feels frustrated and powerless, which I think he kind of is. And that speech he gave was just insulting. It really was. Saying that we'd be speaking German now or Japanese, and first of all, we just wouldn't be. That's not how it would have played out. But second, yeah. we also fought, and so it was just so insulting and unnecessary to say that. Just antagonistic.
It's kind of hilarious that he said you'd all be speaking German now, and he was in Zurich.
Yeah,
where they all speak German.
Yeah,
he's so detached from reality.
yeah, it just seems like he's past his best.
Yeah, I do think he's giving off a kind of senile vibe, honestly, and I'm worried about it. And frankly, I'm worried about this kind of stuff because I'm very worried that he will go down to defeat. First, his party will go down to defeat later this year in the midterm elections. And then in 2028, the left will regain control of the White House. And at that point, I just think, you know, stick a fork in America, she's done. I really do think that Trump is the system's last hope. You know, it's the only way that we can, you know, save Trump and people like him. Following him are the only way that we can undo some of the terrible damage that's already been done to America. And even that's a long shot. So if the left gets back into power, I just think America is going to become unlivable. And that would be a terrible thing. I'm not one of these people who says America must be destroyed because where would my friends live? Where would my American friends live? You know, we live here, you know, we can't just, have this attitude. I want America to get fixed. So, I do have hope that Trump or people like him can do it. And if that is undermined by Trump himself, well, that'd be a terrible thing. So anything that can right some of the wrongs that Trump has done and to do them quickly, I think is a good sign. Now, this war coming up, I'm just appalled by the thought of it. I do think that if the United States actually starts a war with Iran, first of all, I don't think they can actually do proper war like they did with Iraq in 2003. America is a lot weaker as a country than it was in 2003, for one thing. And Iran is a much stronger country than Iraq. So if there's the least bit of sanity in military planning circles in Washington, they know these things. And so they're going to try and do something quick and cheap and showy, like what they did with Maduro, or you know, the bombing run that they did, which might have been totally ineffectual and all for show anyway, against Iran last year, that so-called 12-day war. They might try to do something like that. But even if they tried to do something like that, they could be seriously bloodied by this. Iran has already said that if the United States launches any of its assets from any of its neighboring countries, that it will retaliate against those countries. How might it retaliate against Qatar? Well, setting ablaze its oil and gas industry, for one. If that is done, and it is totally within their power to do this, that could cause the collapse of all these Gulf monarchies, frankly, because I think they have kind of fragile political systems that are basically held together by money. And what if all their oil fields and gas wells are aflame? I don't think the money's going to be rolling in. If Dubai gets hypersonic missiles crashing down on it, like Tel Aviv did last year, that can do a lot of damage. So they could do a lot of damage to the area, and they could sink an American aircraft carrier too. I just don't think the United States could handle that kind of humiliation. And so this is a very dangerous game that's being played. And I hope somehow it's all called off. Somehow there'll be some face-saving show where Trump says, "I got my deal." Yeah, it'll be basically the same as the deal that Obama signed that Trump has been denouncing for more than a decade. That's my hope. I hope that it'll come to nothing. But the world is sick of this man holding them hostage. And on some level, I think Trump enjoys the attention. But the trouble is that you can't run a society that way. I think Trump enjoys keeping people guessing. You can't run an economy that way. So, we want this done. We want this over with as quickly as possible.
Yeah, of course. This just doesn't seem to be serving anyone's interests, certainly not no one in the West. So it's absurd. And if they do launch some kind of war, I don't know what the justification for it will be. I don't know what the pretext will be, because I don't see how it benefits any Americans or Europeans. So what's the point?
It basically benefits Israel, which is calling the shots here. It's wagging the dog here. And people increasingly see that. And it's very unpopular in America. Israel's a declining society in some ways. America's definitely a declining society in some ways. When you're in decline, that often doesn't lead to caution. It leads to recklessness, because you think it's now or never. If we don't do this now, we may never be able to do this. If we don't get America into a war now with Zion Dawn, we may never be able to do this. They're trying to get one last squeeze out of America before it becomes a second-rate power, or where it becomes... Basically, when the boomers start dying off and Jewish influence starts fading, they won't be able to push, get America into another war. If Vance were president now, I think things would be very different. I just don't think that the younger generation is as susceptible to the Israeli influence as the older generation, people like Trump. So anyway, I do worry about this. I do worry that because... We can't do this, that might actually be an argument for some of these people to accelerate this disaster. And I just don't want to see that happen. So yeah, folks, I
agree.
Yeah, we are out of time. I want to make sure that we haven't missed any questions here. Just give me 1 second. Disembodied Voice sends 2 more $3 super chats. With all his cucking, Faraj gives off a big In the Epstein Files energy, and Rupert very much doesn't. I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. And he also writes in, Suella Braverman and Robert Jenrick are both married to Jews. Nigel keeps talking about Judeo-Christian values. Yeah, well, I mean, that's definitely safe talk, you know, the Judeo-Christian thing. Yeah, basically, we don't want that establishment replicating itself in a new body. and that's what Faraj is offering. So, folks, that seems to be it. Thank you, all of you super chatters and listeners. You've had a good large audience out there. Really appreciate it. Woz, thank you so much for joining us. How do people follow your work?
Well, you can find me on X, Telegram, Substack, Rumble and Odyssey, but I'm most active on X and Substack.
Excellent. And I have just decided to put a little more energy into Substack myself, since I am not banned there, but I am banned on X and blacklisted there for some reason. And so if you want to look at the New Nationalism Substack, that is my presence on that platform. I'm trying to build it up a bit myself. But otherwise, of course, it's Countercurrents is my main platform. We will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. And in the meantime, just keep reading Countercurrents.